we think that many people would be willing to trade off some of the growth as long as that growth is going to a relatively poor segment of the population.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. We don't know much about mobility in developing countries compared to the wealthier, data-rich societies that have been the subjects of so much recent research. What does the data tell us so far, and what's it important to find out? Debraj Ray of NYU and Garance Génicot of Georgetown are two of the authors of a new overview of the literature that discusses the data and the methodology we use. They join me now. Debraj, welcome back.
Hi, Tim.
And Garance, welcome.
Hello.
Debraj, why do we study mobility in developing countries? Why should we study it?
Yeah, let me step back for a second and think of development. You know, economic development is social welfare from a plethora of different perspectives, you know, ranging from economic growth to inequality to poverty, health, self-esteem, and so forth. When economists study this stuff, they typically summarize it in a relatively small number of summary indicators. For example, rates of per capita growth, economic inequality, and upward mobility. None of these smaller indicators can be taken in isolation, but they speak to some aspect of development as a whole. So it is in this context that we emphasize upward mobility as opposed to mobility. So let me try to make the distinction here. For example, mobility is a relatively broad concept in its own right. We can use this idea to describe pure movement. For example, geographical movement, the movement of people between, let's say, New Delhi and Calcutta, right? Or we could think of occupational movement. Now, these objects, because they refer to movement across horizontal categories, as it were, has no particular social connotations, just movement, right? Upward mobility, however, is utterly welfare laden, okay, going back to that broader background that I told you. And that's our preference for what we study. Now, this is not just about movement. It's about upward movement. So it has two components that become absolutely central when we think about it. The first is that movement up. Or what is the word up referring to? Well, that's your favorite category, income, wealth, consumption, whatever, right? But movement up in that space is better than movement down. And the second component that Garance and I in our earlier work have brought to the table is that faster movement by the relatively poor in that category has to be a better thing. So these are two ethical prescriptions. The first is that upward movement and downward movement are asymmetric objects. Okay, we don't treat them in a symmetric way. And second, in the category we're thinking about, let's say wealth, look at the relatively poor. If they're moving relatively faster than their richer counterparts, then that's a better thing. So look at these two components that I just told you about. Now, notice that neither is a deal breaker by itself. For example, if you have faster growth by anyone, it doesn't matter equal or unequal, it's more mobile compared to stagnation. So it's not always that the second criterion of relatively poorer doing better is a deal breaker. Conversely, even on overall stagnation in the economy as a whole, we would still say there is upward mobility if in the context of that overall stagnation, the relatively poor are outstripping the relatively rich. So both of these components are important, and neither component is a complete deal breaker. And finally, I want to reemphasize the fact that once we put the two components together, we get the notion of upward mobility that Garance and I developed, and this is still one component of overall development. But it's an interesting object to focus on, and that's what we do. So you see, the distinction comes up here between absolute and relative. So the first of those two criteria that I told you have to do with absolute. So people are growing, that's a good thing. A good example of that is what Raj Chetty and his co-authors look at. They look at where the children of a particular generation are doing better than their parents, right? Now that's absolute notion because we're just asking if they're just doing better in some absolute sense. Whereas the second component is fundamentally relativistic. It is asking whether the relatively worse off are doing better than the relatively better off. Now, we could develop a measure of mobility which retains both of these desiderata, and that would give us a measure of upward mobility that is sensitive to these social considerations. Or we could strip away the first one. We could just ask whether the relatively poor are doing relatively better than the relatively rich. And that would give us a pure measure of relative mobility. So you see, the conceptual work that Garance and I did managed to develop a pair of measures, and each of which is intimately connected to the other via this notion of aggregate growth in the economy as a whole. And both are important.
Okay, so let's have a look at the data that we have so far and what you have been able to do. Now, there is, as I said, a lot of research into mobility, upward mobility in high-income countries. I said that there's less for low- and middle-income countries. Why is there less?
One of the reasons why there's much less research in developing countries is that most measures of mobility do require a link between an individual's income at two different points in time. So we need to know what a person earns at one point in time and what they earn at another point in time. Or if we are talking about intergenerational mobility, we need to know what their parents was earning and what they're earning. And so that requires panel data on an individual or retrospective information in a household survey on what the parents were earning. It's very rare to actually have retrospective information on income data. So we have retrospective information sometimes on education, sometimes on occupation, but very rarely on earnings of the parents. So it means that to measure mobility with measures of mobility that require panel data, we would need a long panel information. And though it exists for some countries, so Indonesia is one example, this is very rare in the context of developing countries. Another strategy that has been used in high-income countries is to get panel information from tax data. So Bracetti has used panel information from tax data. However, even if we had access to those tax information in developing countries in context where more than 60% of the economy is informal, the tax data in many countries, it goes up to 90%, the tax information would not give you access to the information that you need. So we have very little information on income mobility in developing countries.
Week after week on Vox Dev Talks, we discuss how volatile people's incomes are, especially the sort of people whose upward mobility, I imagine it would be very interesting to measure. And as you say, how much of their income is never reported. This must be a problem if we even try to compile this sort of panel data.
Oh, for sure. And this is not just about mobility. This is true about even both about income, about. So a large portion of economic activity in developing countries occurs in the informal sector, which is inherently difficult to measure accurately. Income of self-employed and subsistence agriculture can be irregular and hard to quantify. Many people, households rely on in-kind payments, self-produced goods. So this is very hard, but this is why in developing countries we often use consumption information as opposed to income information because it tends to be more stable and better represent a household's living standard. Averaging income over multiple years is another strategy that people have used to smooth out short-term fluctuation as income tend to be maybe fluctuate more in developing countries. So there are strategies that we use to get around some of those data difficulties.
And using this, can you sort of fill in the gaps and create something approximating the sort of panel data that you would use for a country like the UK or the US?
people have tried to approximate data and to make assumptions. So, for instance, assume some level of correlation between income of parents and income of children, and then use that to be able to use repeated cross-section. This is certainly one valuable strategy, but you need panel data to get initially to that correlation. If you're using a measure of mobility, that requires panel data.
You have a method that you have developed that does not need panel data. Tell me about this, the Jenico-Rey method.
So this is where we start pulling rabbits, dead or alive, out of a hat.
It sounds like it, yeah.
Hopefully alive, but we'll see. Okay, so here's the situation. So on the face of it, all of this looks weird. How are we going to even measure mobility if we give up the notion of panel data, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I want you to consider the following distinction. Let's think about whether a particular dynasty, let's say the Rockefellers or the Birlas or the Goenkas or the Carlos Slims, right? We want to look at a particular dynasty, how they're moving around over time. Then, of course, there is no way of getting around the issue that we have to collect data on their variable of interest over time. But now let's shift the question slightly and ask a slightly different question. Whether society as a whole, not looking at any particular dynasty, but society as a whole is upwardly mobile or not. And then what I'd like you to do is for a moment, think of a snapshot of time and let's ask ourselves at that snapshot of time, when is a society more mobile or less mobile? Going back to our two criteria, you know, we want to see if society is growing as a whole or how different groups are doing. And we want to see if the relatively poor, given whatever variable we're interested in, if the relatively poor are doing better than the relatively rich. Now, notice that the identity of the relatively poor, who they are, whether the Rockefellers or the Birlas, need not concern us at the moment, okay? Assuming that we've got the variable measured right. Of course, there are problems with the variable itself, right? But assuming that issue away, which is separate from the panel assumption, just at that moment, we want to know if the relatively poor are doing better than the relatively rich. Now, let's suppose we go on in time, and these two dynasties happen to cross paths. And now they've changed positions and the relatively rich has become the relatively poor.
Yes.
Now, as soon as they switch paths, notice that from a social angle, from the point of view of measuring mobility, we now forget about the fact that these guys were relatively rich before because they've done their time. Now they're relatively poor. They get a different set of weights as far as our mobility measure is concerned. So in other words, the identity of the relatively poor and the relatively rich may be fluid, but our measure only looks for those who are relatively rich or relatively poor at any one point of time, and then aggregates up those instantaneous mobilities, if you like, over different points of time. Now, in doing that, we don't need to worry about exactly whose name is attached to the relatively rich or the relatively poor. There seems something odd about this. So let's try to understand what might be odd. The reason why this thing might be odd is that the variable that we are interested in capturing, let's say wealth or consumption or income, is a sloppy variable somehow. We are not measuring it right. So this is going back to our earlier concept. Even when you have overtaken me at a different point of time, you may not have really overtaken me. In other words, because the variable is being measured with noise, may need to keep echoes of Tim's past in the upward mobility measure. But notice how this is intimately connected to the fact of whether we've got the variable measured right. If we've got the variable measured right and we have a sufficient description of Tim's current well-being, then mobility does not need to know whether it's Tim or Debraj at the top of the heap or the other way around. And this is how we get rid of the panel information. There are some cases where getting rid of this panel information may be extremely difficult. Imagine that you belong to a particular caste group in India, and I belong to another caste group in India. And these castes have caste incomes, and they have their own burden of the past. So then, even if you and I are blithely moving around, me becoming relatively rich, you becoming relatively rich, our caste is still constant. Mm-hmm. Can't take that away. So what Garance and I do in our paper is we actually extend this measure to keep track of these social labels over and above our incomes. And then it turns out that you do need panel data, but you need panel data only at the level of the social grouping and not at the level of the individual. And now panel data at the level of a social grouping is far easier to get.
Tracking individuals is a sort of convenience because the data is available and it makes it tractable to do it. But what a policymaker is going to be more interested in is what you're talking about here, which is how groups are moving relative to each other.
That's correct. And I'll go out on a limb. I don't know whether Garance will come with me on that limb. I suspect she will, which is that even if we had the individual data in a panel, our measure of mobility would say that you should discard it. It has no additional value except keeping track of who's relatively rich and who's relatively poor. If, of course, you're suspicious of the variable that you're measuring, you think that that's not a good statistic, then by all means, you use the panel data when you have it.
Imagine a situation where two individuals are crossing. Essentially, what our measure is saying is if you look at the full interval and if those two individuals are swapping their position, what we end up having is a situation where, like in the beginning, it's upwardly mobile because the poorest person is growing faster than the richer person. So this is valued in our measure. But then at the moment where they cross, they swap their position in the second part of the situation. What happens is that actually the relatively richer person is growing faster than the relatively poor. This is actually bringing down the upward mobility. And so at the end, it vanished, like it averaged out. So a situation where those two individuals would actually converge to each other would be more upwardly mobile, according to our measure, than a situation where those individuals are swapping position.
By the way, that also tells us why upward mobility and mobility as pure movement are different concepts. Because there could be a lot of movement, but no net upward mobility in the end.
We might have to update the way that we label these terms, mightn't we?
Oh, yeah, it's a big issue in how we label, how we call something can be very difficult. And this is why you always want to think about what you are exactly measuring, not just use the name. Yes.
From the existing research, and we've discussed the constraints on the existing research, how much upward mobility is there in developing countries compared to high-income countries?
In terms of mobility, we have way better information because of the data constraint. We have way better information in terms of the educational mobility. So there's a very nice report by the World Bank and a recent paper in the GDE that is summarizing a lot of the information that we have from measure of intergenerational elasticity or absolute mobility in terms of education, and trying to really gather what we know from as many countries as possible. And then in the 2018 World Bank report, they report what we have in terms of some of the intergenerational mobility in terms of income. Mm-hmm. In terms of education, what they find is that developing countries tend to have lower level of educational mobility than richer countries, which might be surprising because there's some upper limits in terms of education that you might think one can reach. That would hint at countries that have lower level of education having more scope for absolute mobility in terms of education. Mm-hmm. But they tend to find that India and Sub-Saharan Africa have the lowest rate of educational mobility.
Gosh, that surprises me.
I don't know if it's surprising, but the difference between high income and lower income might be more surprising. In terms of income, their report contrasts high income and low income countries, and they tend to find similar patterns, but this is harder to assess. Like there's more issue with the way the income elasticity is actually calculated and not using the same data for different countries.
I think these results also to some extent depend on the particular index of mobility. By the way, there's like thousands of these indices out there. depending on how sensitive the index is to the lower end, you get either this relationship that Garon's talked about, but some studies you sometimes see, depending on the measure, a U-shaped relationship, where the very poorest countries and the very richest countries have the highest mobility in terms of education, but then there's a trough in the middle.
Yes, whether you use correlation or you use intergenerational elasticity, you tend to find different patterns, yes.
So talk to me about the insights that you have been able to produce with your method. What have you discovered?
With Carolina Concha Ariagadar, we applied the measure of upward mobility to WID data in order to have like consistent estimates of upward mobility for as many countries and years that we could. And remember what Debrash introduced, that we had two measures, an absolute measure of upward mobility and a relative measure of upward mobility. So we could actually calculate both of them for all countries, and that gives us nice information or overview. Some things that may not be surprising is that over the 90 to 2018 period, we find that Asia has been the region that has been the most upwardly mobile. Mm-hmm. That's not particularly surprising. We find that the relatively richer countries have been less mobile during this region. So this is Oceania, Europe, US, and Canada. But remember that our measure can be decomposed in terms of growth and in terms of how much that growth has been more pro-poor versus pro-rich within the distribution. And what we find is that when you look at Latin America and Oceania, Europe, USA, and Canada, for instance, their growth was very similar. But the relatively rich countries had actually a negative relative upward mobility. This means that growth has been more concentrated among the relatively richer segment of the society compared to in Latin America, where there was more redistribution. When you contrast Asia, for instance, the upward mobility in absolute terms comes from very high growth. Everybody knows the example of India and China over those 30 years where the growth has been really high, but that growth has been quite disequalizing. Mm-hmm. So has benefited way more the upper segment of the society. And so when you look at the relative upward mobility over the 30 years, for the region, this is actually null. But that hides a big decrease in relative mobility for India, for instance, where growth has been very disequalizing. When you look at Africa, for instance, what you see is a very different picture. So their absolute upward mobility has been relatively low, but this is mainly coming from low growth. And actually, the relative upward mobility has been positive. So there's a number of countries where growth has happened. It has happened more for the lower segment of the population. I find it quite interesting to always contrast a measure of absolute upward mobility with the relative mobility to understand the different component, whether growth has been high, do we have shared prosperity or not within the society.
It is fascinating because it gives a narrative to development and growth, that just measuring these raw mobility, upward mobility figures very often, you get a number, but you're not entirely sure what that number means.
Exactly, exactly. And you know, there's been a lot of discussion, maybe in the popular literature, but you see some movement coming from Japan about degrowth. We don't want to say that growth is bad. Growth has been one of the biggest engines of reducing poverty. What we want to highlight is that we think that many people would be willing to trade off some of the growth as long as that growth is going to a relatively poor segment of the population. So we are willing to take less growth of the average income or aggregate income in a country. And what our measure does is to make that trade-off explicit. there is a particular pro-poor coefficient that a country, that an organization, that an individual interested in can choose to decide on the particular trade-off that they have between aggregate growth and between pro-poor growth. Our measure is a nice way to capture shared prosperity or to capture that trade-off.
I really want to speak to our fellow development economists. If you want to look for a measure of upward mobility in the literature, you'll find 20 of them. You want to look for measures of relative mobility, you'll find another 20 of them. The point is to develop these measures from a set of first principles, which, as Garros was saying, allows us to explicitly do two things. One is to connect absolute and relative mobility in an intimate way via the growth rate. So that's one thing. And the second is to be able to express this trade-off between growth and pro-poor growth, ideally by reference to a single parameter. Now, that parameter, Garros and I can't pin down. The parameter has to be pinned down by the policymaker or by the researcher or by the organization who has a particular ethical judgment between how much to give up one for the other. But once you pin down the parameter, our measures work very well together in tandem. And that's precisely because we've used these axioms, if you will, these baseline starting points where everything is explicit. You want to quarrel with the measures? Be our guest, but you'll have to go to one of those axioms and say, I don't like that particular axiom. And that, I think, is the great virtue of the approach that we are taking.
Another piece of work that you've done in the paper is to estimate the Great Gatsby curve for more countries. That piece of work focused on OECD countries. Now, on your Great Gatsby curve, there are many more. Can you explain to people exactly what the curve is and what you found out?
The so-called Great Gatsby curve is referred to a positive cross-sectional relationship between income inequality and intergenerational income persistence that was identified by Korak in 2013 and made famous by Alan Kruger in a speech in the White House in 2012. And the brilliance of Kruger was to select that name, the Great Gatsby curve, that stays with us. So what Kruger wanted to demonstrate is that the United States was particularly unequal and having low mobility. And that led to a compelling prediction, is that maybe because we are more unequal now that we are in a generation ago, then we should expect even lower social mobility going forward. In terms of the relationship between inequality and mobility, theory tells us that it could go both ways. It's not that clear. So which way it should go? So if we think about arguments that would favor convergence or any form of regression to the mean, we might think that when we have had more inequality, there's going to be more equalization that is going to follow. And so this would suggest that more inequality should help upward mobility or help mobility. On the other hand, if we think about any argument that has to do with poverty traps, then we might think that actually having higher inequality is going to make inequality build on itself and is then going to cause more disequalization. So this is like, Debraj and I have worked on like frustrated aspirations that could justify, for instance, such a buildup of inequality building on itself. When we did look at the data with the help of Carolina, what we did is to actually look at the relationship with our measure of upward mobility applied to WID data and look at a 30-year period to make it comparable to measure of intergenerational mobility. And we correlate it with the initial inequality. And what we found is that When we look at the initial countries that COAG used, then we find also a slight negative relationship between inequality and mobility. Mm-hmm. It tends to disappear, not to be statistically significant when we add some all higher income countries. However, when we look at developing countries, we see very different pattern. In Asia, or especially in Africa, we see that the most mobility has happened in countries that were more unequal to start with. And so that tends to push for a relationship between more inequality being correlated with more subsequent mobility. Those are big cross-country comparison. It does not tell us anything about the mechanism. There's no reason to think that if we look at intergenerational elasticity, it would give us the same pattern, because those are different measures. So much more work is needed to go and understand what is happening when we look at overtime in countries. Where is this relationship coming from? Is it, for instance, due to more education or not, or to improvement in education, or to sectorial change? I think there's a fascinating research agenda to better understand this.
Imagine that I'm a policymaker and I'm looking at your research. But as a policymaker, I want to provide equality of opportunity. What can I take from your work that might help me in policy terms?
I think it's a little difficult to take our work directly in order to be able to tell that. What I think that one can do from our work is to use our measure of mobility to see in your country, in your region, what seems to be causing a higher upward mobility, and to then understand what you need to do more of or less of. I think our measure is giving you a very nice way of looking at shared prosperity, an easy way. You just need two cross-sectional data to measure upward mobility, relative and aggregate. And so I think that you can use those data very easily to see in your country what seems to cause higher upward mobility or not, or higher shared prosperity.
I want to embed the Great Gatsby curve into a somewhat broader phenomenon. And to do that, think of the Great Gatsby curve as something, let's say, that's relating relative mobility to initial inequality. Now, we remember that the relative mobility itself can be dispensed with, and we can go to absolute mobility as well. So there are two measures to look at, if you like, on the so-called y-axis of this curve. Now, on the x-axis, there are two measures as well. There's inequality, which is the one that's typically used, but we can also look at other characteristics of the existing income distribution, such as how polarized is it. So we could ask, Great Gatsby Redux, right? What's the relationship between absolute mobility and polarization of a distribution? You see what I mean? Just by this little example I gave you, we can think of at least four curves: absolute to polarization, absolute to inequality, relative to polarization, and relative to inequality. So all of this is stuff that we are actually currently engaged in exploring. If you come back to us in 6 months or maybe a year, we will be able to tell you about these detailed findings. And then, and I'd like to emphasize, only then can we talk more about the kind of policy intervention that you have in mind, which I think are the ultimate goal of this entire line of analysis. Garance, is that okay with you?
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay.
I think a year.
Stay tuned, guys. Stay tuned.
Seeing as we've brought that up, you've opened a box here and you're going to be doing some more research on this. There might be a lot of other people that are listening to this and thinking, I really want to dig into this as well. What research is it important to do? What do you think needs to be done here?
Oh, I was just talking to a colleague at the NBR Summer Institute, for instance, that is trying to provide a very accurate growth accounting of the role of education looking at growth. And I think that this is, for instance, very easily can be adapted to looking at the role of education, which would help us linking education or the increase in educational prevalence with upward mobility. I think we provide a measure that can be applied widely by many individuals, whether it's to look at what are the consequences of upward mobility, what's increasing upward mobility. I think the beauty of a measure is that it can be applied to many projects.
Thank you very much. We'll be back in touch in 12 months' time when I will be reviewing your latest work. But for now, Garance, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
And Debraj, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Tim.
The paper is called Upward Mobility in Developing Countries, and the authors are Garance Génicot, Debraj Rey, and Carolina Concha Arraguiat. It is NBER Working Paper 32391. Now, also, if you're interested in the Génicot-Rey method, then look for Measuring Upward Mobility by Génicot and Rey in the American Economic Review, volume 113, number 11, that was published in 2023. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe to us. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you do enjoy Vox Dev Talks, we certainly hope you do, then please rate us. 5 stars is best. And tell other people about us. And then more people can get to hear conversations like this one.